UHF is running called the Child Health Transportation Initiative. And it's been funded by Kellogg and the Federal Transit Administration. In a nutshell, what we're trying to do with this initiative is to identify some solutions that are going to work on the ground to improve child health care access in terms of transportation. There are three major components of this initiative. Roy and Mark have been involved in the first major one, which is the research bit, and Roy essentially guided the nationally representative survey that was done by Marist that he discussed previously, and Mark has been helping me get a much clearer picture of transportation as a barrier to healthcare access on the ground. We've been working primarily in Mississippi, Arkansas, and Tennessee to date. There's also a public education and advocacy component, which involves meetings like this, trying to get the word out that transportation is, in fact, something that we really need to pay attention to. We're also developing a number of articles for publication, and we also are hoping to do a little bit of advocacy on behalf of the Transportation Initiative with state and national legislators. The thing I'm going to talk about today is what we've done in terms of pilot project development. And we've got currently a set of pilot projects that we've initiated and another set of pilot projects that are going to be initiated very shortly. And so I'm going to give you a little bit of a progress report on some of these projects and talk about what we were hoping to accomplish, what we still hope to accomplish, and what we've seen so far. Initially, Roy mentioned earlier in his presentation that there are lots of things that can go wrong if kids don't have access to appropriate transportation. And if this cursor works here, Roy was talking mainly about this third one, increased use of emergency room care and the associated use of emergency transportation to get to care. But of course, there are other things as well that can go wrong if we don't have appropriate access to transportation, including, for example, increase in preventable hospitalizations, and incidence of untreated chronic disease, asthma being a primary example of this. And as Steve was alluding to in his presentation, when you're in areas where there are difficulties gaining access to care because it's a health professional shortage area, for example, the issues are exacerbated. So we've tended to focus on states like Mississippi and Arkansas and Tennessee precisely because those areas have considerable difficulties gaining access to health professionals. And we've had a number of working assumptions that we've used throughout the course of developing our pilot projects. Mark mentioned one of them, which is that we're just simply not assuming a lot of additional resources are going to be made available for improving transportation. And that we've also been assuming, based on research that we've reviewed, based on our own research, and based on a lot of other information, stuff that Steve was mentioning, for example, that if we do invest in transportation, it's likely to be cost-beneficial, or at least cost-effective. And so those are going to be good investments, and they're the sorts of things that we'd like to see. So we've been assuming that, right? So in terms of developing the specifics of our project, we focused really on trying to do two things, trying to increase the efficiency with which existing resources are used, or developing cost-effective alternatives to what's already been done, or what's already being done on the ground in any given location. It's a little fortuitous for us at the moment because right now there is a federal initiative underway that Mark just mentioned called United We Ride. And United We Ride is an outgrowth of an executive order that President Bush signed back in 2004. Essentially, the idea is that there are 62 separate funding streams from the federal government that are funding human resources transportation. And this executive order essentially obligates states to develop coordinated transportation plans, right? And this would mean, in theory, that a transportation asset used by one particular agency or one particular program could be coordinated with assets and resources used by others. This initiative is being implemented by the Community Transportation Association of America through what they call their ambassadors program, and these individuals are going from state to state and through a series of workshops helping states to develop their coordinated plans. Now, the success of this initiative, I should think, is somewhat variable. For example, if you go to Mississippi, they're well along the way to having very good coordinated transportation plans developed. In other states, it's not so further progressed. And in each case, they're working with the state departments of transportation, so it's a difficult thing. It's a very difficult bureaucratic issue to deal with, because you're talking ultimately about sharing vehicles at some stage, or sharing transportation funding. So, but in some respects, it's good for us, because now that there's this impetus from the federal government to try and coordinate resources, we can piggyback on to what these states are already doing. And that's what we're attempting to do, at least in a couple of places. So this is what we want to do overall. Basically, the idea is that we want to develop some innovative transportation projects that are going to increase kids' access to care. And we want to hopefully develop a set of guidelines or a toolkit, if you will, that would allow other communities to learn from what we've learned on the ground and perhaps implement an innovative child health transportation program in their area. So at the end of this project, which is a 3-year project, one of the outputs we want to produce is a nice set of guidelines for what communities can do and what they should watch out for when they're trying to establish a new program. So I'm going to talk about the first group of pilot projects that we've initiated. And this first group of projects, they're all with partner organizations of the Children's Health Fund. As Roy mentioned, we have programs around the country. These are usually partnerships with teaching hospitals or large community health centers, and we help them establish and maintain mobile clinical services. So you can't really see that too well, but let me find my cursor again. There's Gulfport right there and Biloxi. Now, in Biloxi, there is an organization called the Coastal Family Health Center, and that's we've got a partnership program with them. And that health center has a number of branches throughout the Gulf Coast. I'm trying to find my cursor again. There it is. And the mobile units serve mobile sites all along this Gulf Coast here, from Pascagoula, way over here near the Alabama border, all the way over to Bay St. Louis, which is relatively close to the Louisiana border. So there are mobile sites all through that area. Now, when Mark and I went down to do a site visit in this area, it became very clear that one of the problems was that there were huge numbers of people who had been displaced by Katrina. So we had gone down there effectively not long after that. And talking to local stakeholders, health providers, and transit providers as well, it was pretty clear to us that you had all these people being shipped out to various FEMA camps that were really far from population centers, and people simply did not have access to public services of any kind. So it seemed to us an ideal place to try and implement a new program to increase transportation access for people who needed to get access to health care. So the first thing we did is we decided that we would establish a feeder route. And there was one particular FEMA camp that was a relatively large one, and it was expected to grow, triple or quadruple in size, as FEMA had planned to consolidate a number of other FEMA camps into this one big place and effectively turn it into a semi-permanent community. So we decided to focus on that particular community initially. We contacted the Coast Transit Authority, which is the local transit outfit on the Gulf Coast, and they agreed to provide us with a brand new 15-passenger van that had been donated to them, and we would essentially establish a route from this FEMA park, which, if I can get my cursor again, is right up here. It's about 35 miles northwest of Gulfport, and it is in the middle of nowhere. It's actually in a campground, a trailer park, so it's meant to be in the middle of nowhere. There are no public services of any kind around. It's out in the bush, so to speak. And this feeder route would travel into Gulfport along the way, stopping at a number of key places, like a job center, a behavioral health center. There's been research done by CHF as well as a sister organization called the National Center for Disaster Preparedness that shows that there are serious mental health issues in these Gulf Coast residents, particularly the ones who have been displaced, and the Coastal Family Health Center sites, and then all the way down to this last stop here, which is labeled number 1, and that site is a transit hub. And so people would then be linked into the rest of the Coast Transit Authority's fixed route system. So it's providing a way of people to get into town, get to health care, perhaps do a little shopping, look for a job, and then use the rest of the system to perhaps get to a job or additional health care. So we set that up several months ago, and we started the system out on a 3-times-a-week basis, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, running back and forth into Gulfport 3 times a day. Here's how it turned out in the short term. It looks as if this consolidation process that we had thought was going to take place, it doesn't appear to be happening. So there are still, I don't know, a dozen or so FEMA parks located around in this area, and they're not being consolidated. And in fact, the population at this one particular park is dwindling, starting to decrease as people are presumably moving away. So it doesn't really make sense for us anymore to run this van service as a routine route. And we've decided for the time being that we're going to run it as a demand response route. So in other words, someone from the camp can call up and book a ride on the van. But what we've decided to do is something a little more ambitious, because the first thing didn't work out so well. Now, we have, as I mentioned, we have mobile units that service all 3 counties in the Gulf Coast area, and we're going to use the van to essentially increase the radius of that mobile unit's catchment area, because as it's at a particular stop point, there are only going to be a certain number of people who can gain access to that mobile visit site, and we'd like to increase that. So the van is essentially going to shadow the mobile unit and bring patients into the site during different stops. Now, there are 2 mobile units operating out of our partner down there. One is a mobile clinic, and one is a mobile mental health unit. And another thing that we're thinking through and discussing with Coast Transit Authority is possibly getting a second van to do the same thing with the mobile mental health unit. This is very critical, of course, because patients who are seeing psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, they need to be seen just more than once. And so it's important for them to come back routinely. And if a van like this can increase their ability to do so, then we should see, I think, better health outcomes. In terms of how we're going to measure whether this is effective or not, we want to look, first of all, at a very simple indicator, the pediatric patients or riders, if you will, per time period. But we also want to look at pediatric asthma patients who are presenting at the mobile unit site as a percentage of total pediatric asthma patients, because, of course, asthma is a very ambulatory sensitive condition. And if you get kids seeing routine primary care for asthma, you're likely to see reductions in hospitalizations and emergency use of transportation and vehicles to get to a hospital. As I mentioned before, as we're working out the logistics of this, because it's a lot more complicated, and it looks as if we're going to run it as essentially a pre-scheduled service in which people would, through their interactions with the clinicians, they would essentially schedule visits on a weekly basis. And that's a lot more difficult to do than simply running a van back and forth from a fixed site. So we're going to run the van as a demand response service in the meantime. Now we switch to the Mississippi Delta, and let me point out 3 places. Here's Memphis. Here is that Mariana? That's Mariana in Arkansas. And this is Clarksdale in Mississippi. Now, we have partner programs in both Clarksdale and in Mariana, and a new program that's just beginning as we speak in Memphis. So what we're doing in Mariana, they have their own set of vans. It's their own transportation department, but it's very poorly managed. The vans are being run haphazardly all over the place. There is no real coordination of those resources. The other thing that's happening is that they're giving rides to Medicaid NEMT-eligible patients. So there is a local Medicaid transport broker who should, in theory, be providing rides for those patients. And, of course, they're already getting paid to do that, but it turns out that clinics vans are giving rides to a number of those patients. So we want to try and shift those patients over to the broker and improve healthcare access for kids in the area. What we've done so far, or these are the characteristics of what we've done, we've established a post of a transportation coordinator through resources provided to us by the CTAA, the Community Transportation Association of America. We've developed some new tools for managing those transport assets, and we've given them a little bit of training in how to use those tools. We're going to help them use the waiver provision because, of course, if a clinician signs a waiver form and faxes it through to the transport broker, the Medicaid broker should, in theory, pick up that patient right away instead of having to wait for a 48-hour notice period. And what we'd like to do ultimately is outsource some of the management of the clinic's transportation wing to the local Medicaid transport broker. The other thing I want to mention, as Roy is kicking my leg over here that I've got very little time left, is we're going to use one of the clinic's vans as a kids' van for referring pediatric patients to Memphis, the hospital in Memphis, which is Le Bonheur Children's Health Center. And also there's going to be a pediatrician coming from Le Bonheur once per week to our clinic in Marianna, and we're going to use that van to sweep in kids when that pediatrician is in town. Indicators. We're going to look at some very basic transportation indicators like ridership. And we're also going to be looking at numbers of patients that pitch up on pediatrician day and whether we can successfully complete referrals, pediatric referrals, from Marianna to Memphis. So far, we've had site visits, we've developed some tools, we've done initial training, and we've had some initial meetings with Arkansas's Medicaid Managed Care Services, because there is a potential problem, and this is related to something that Steve mentioned. In the Medicaid NEMT legislation, remember he said that states must provide necessary transportation. As it turns out, that might be a loophole for Medicaid transportation brokers, precisely because the clinic has its own van. And so, in theory, the Medicaid transportation broker could refuse to provide transportation to Medicaid patients because another source of transportation is already available. So that's something we're trying to work out, and we've scheduled a number of meetings with the Arkansas state folks, and hopefully we're going to come to a conclusion on that before too long. Finally, Clarksdale, Mississippi. There's a lot of evidence, anecdotal at this point, that the emergency room is being used by folks with non-emergency conditions. So we want to try and reduce that. We want to try and reduce preventable hospitalization and the use of emergency transportation to get to that hospital care. So what we're going to be doing is a survey of non-emergency conditions, patients with non-emergency conditions at the Northwest Regional Medical Center, which is a major hospital in that area. And once we've completed that survey, we're going to do some targeted solutions based on what we find, one of which might be establishing a new route. There is a transit outfit called DARTS in the area that runs a number of rural routes. There are some key communities that don't have any access to that system, and there's some evidence that a lot of the patients who are coming to the ER are coming from those communities. So we may simply establish a new route. We also are hoping to negotiate with local primary care providers to extend their clinic hours, because as it turns out, a lot of people are coming to the ER between 5 and 9 p.m. In other words, when they get off work, when mom and dad's car is available. So we'd like to try and work with local providers in that regard. Some of the indicators we're looking at in terms of measuring the impact of this project, we're going to be doing a follow-up survey later on and see what percentage of patients with non-emergency conditions are showing up. And we're going to look at hospitalizations of kids in the hospital with asthma, again, because it's ambulatory sensitive. The survey here, this is a little bit outdated because the survey is going to begin tomorrow, actually. So it's not just this month, but it is on November 8th that it will begin. And then finally, I'm just going to do this very quickly to leave time for questions. These are some additional sites that we're going to be working with as a second group of pilot sites. I'd like to mention just a couple in particular. In New Orleans, we have a new child health project there, a partnership with a hospital in New Orleans in which we're running one of our mobile units. And they have been offered a clinic bus, a bus that a clinic simply can't use. And what we'd like to do is replicate, if it works, the strategy that we're using in Gulfport, where we have a van actually shadowing the mobile unit. And then in Memphis, we've just entered into a brand new relationship with Le Bonheur Children's Hospital there. And as I mentioned, we're going to be using vans from Marianna to bring patients to Le Bonheur. But we're also going to be using, or hopefully working with, local transit providers in the Memphis area to develop some innovative solutions. So that's where we are at the moment. And I think that's it.
Okay, so we have 15 minutes. We'd really like to open this up for questions, discussion, clarification, comments? Yeah, in the back. By the way, I'm going to repeat the question because I think this is all being recorded.
She's wondering, there is a problem, of course, if a child has to go to a healthcare facility, and let's say the mother has three or four kids, needs to take one child to that facility, and of course things like Medicaid, any EMT transportation benefit, only covers the mother as well as the child. And so what do you do with the other kids at home? This is something that we're, of course, dealing with when we're trying to think through what we're doing in terms of our pilot projects. You know, we're Children's Health Fund, we're not a transit outfit, so a lot of this is new to us. But one thing that I saw that might be interesting, I'm not sure exactly how we could implement it, but in Arkansas, for example, under the Our Kids program, which is the SCHIP program in Arkansas, I believe, there are children who are taken on a daily basis to centers for developmental disabilities. And essentially, it's a bus route picking up kids who are going to be going to this center every single day. And on this route, there is an LPN or an RN. And so, in other words, this kid has a guardian on board this bus. And one of the things that we've talked to local folks about is perhaps hiring an LPN or an RN to be on board a bus. And of course, you'd have to have some form of consent from the parents involved so that the child could actually potentially be transported without the parent. And that's a bit controversial. I'm not sure how that's going to work out, but it's one of the things we've been thinking about.
Actually, that question raises something we haven't talked about yet, which is liability, which is a big issue in a lot of this transportation, use of vehicles and so forth. One kind of historically important source of transportation has been the fleet of buses that take children to Head Start programs. That's been around for decades now, and there's always been an emphasis in Head Start that children's parents should volunteer in the classroom. Historically, mothers bring their children to the bus, put their child on the bus, and are on their own to get to the Head Start program because the liability coverage for the Head Start van does not cover them for any injury to an adult that's not working as either the monitor or the bus driver. So, and you know, with regard to siblings, what if not all of the children are covered by Medicaid? Would they then be eligible for the Medicaid benefit? How would that be covered? So I think that we're getting into territory that is going to require some regulatory changes, but before anything like that can happen, it's going to require some very, very intensive focus on first recognizing what the needs are, and then what are some of the barriers historically. But I do think that the insurance issue and the liability issue is one that's going to come up in a major kind of way. There was another hand in the back earlier. Yes. Actually, we have two economists. I think we need a health lawyer here.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question, and we've batted that issue around a lot. I mean, one, could it be a waiver question? You know, where you could ask for an exemption waiver at the state level. But your question in the back about why is it that the law states that only a Medicaid-covered service, that only a child going for Medicaid-covered service can go on that transportation. when it's paid for by Medicaid. So that is a big barrier, and it's the federal regulation. So that's what they keep coming back into. And you know, when we've and Dr. Blakely and I have done a number of evaluations of this program in Texas, and every time you see when we talk to clients, that's the thing that they're frustrated about, why they don't use the program. Says, well, I have a couple of kids, I can't take them. You don't provide me any daycare, but I can't take them with me on this non-emergency medical transportation, so therefore I can't go. And that's a very interesting question. So when we tell the state, these are the findings that we see, they come back and tell us and said, well, it's a federal law, it's not a state law, and that's the problem that we've had changing it. So again, maybe this could be done as a Medicaid waiver to that law, but I don't know. I don't know that any states have approached it.
One of the advocacy positions that can be taken is that CHIP should mirror the Medicaid entitlement, and transportation is included in Medicaid as an enabling service under EPSDT, early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment. The problem with that, the strength of that, is it's already there and it's a precedent that is established in Medicaid. The problem is that states violate EPSDT left and right, and there's a very, very long and troubling history of lawsuits that are not even enforced, so that this isn't even an issue where litigation advocacy works, because you win your case and you still don't get what you're supposed to. And anybody that's interested in checking that out, it's all summarized on the website of something called NHELP, the National Health Law Project, and they have a whole section devoted to EPSDT litigation. And as I say, you win, but it's non-enforced. So I think that the easiest advocacy strategy is to say that the scope of benefits for the state's CHIP program should be essentially Medicaid with an expanded income eligibility. And that would include the, because sometimes oral health, vision screening and services aren't included in SCHIP. Really, what most of us would consider to be essential services are not included. So the advocacy position is that it should all be Medicaid expansion from the standpoint of the scope of benefits, and that would bring transportation in under the EPSDT provision without having to argue about it. Dennis Johnson.
Issues. I think one of the things that we can do at the federal level is to
And that would, I think I'm supposed to repeat all of that, but I won't. That would, if we were able to get the transportation disadvantaged or whatever your transportation shortage area designation, and then could overlay that with the HPSA's, which is problematic because the HPSA designation is so strangely inconsistent in many ways. But if you could find those communities or start with those communities that are clearly health and transportation professional shortage areas and target those for some type of pilot intervention, that might be a way to start. I think that part of our issue is making the case, having the evidence to support the necessity of doing that. I'll get to your question in a second. I was sort of stunned that the word necessary meant transportation necessary, not medically necessary. Right, and that in itself is a problem. It should be transportation for a medically necessary service, not default transportation if nothing else is available. So that another thing that we can do that would solve a lot of access issues that are coming up more and more, as Dennis is right, Medicaid is not what it used to be, and states have the opportunity to cheapen that product, and some have. But as more and more services, rehabilitation services for children with disabilities and so forth are restricted in Medicaid as a payer, strengthening that case of medical necessity would be important, and we might be able to build off of that for transportation for a medically necessary service. Yes. Yeah, I'm done. Walmart's coming up. Do you want to introduce yourself?
As a member of the academic community, what I'm about to say next is particularly painful. I don't know. I would hope there are. I'm more familiar with the topic from an early childhood education standpoint, and there are very definitely cases where early childhood programs have been traced through, and their impacts on school performance in later years have been mapped out. I would hope that there is something similar in terms of healthcare access for kids, but I'm not aware of it.
Okay, we technically are out of time, but if there's one more question, comment, we could take that. Yeah.
For example, a child is going to be transported
It would seem that there's no consistency in the way that things are being done from state to state, and you can't really generalize from one to the other, but I think your point about siblings that are not the designated patient or may not be under the same insurance plan is an enormously important one that, from a regulatory perspective, has to be looked at, because then there still won't be ability to get the health care for the sick kid. Thank you all very, very much for coming. I really appreciate your interest and attention to this topic, because I got to say, not everybody gets it, and I think part of our mission here is to get this important issue out there. Thank you again.